a newsletter is coming to paid Substack subscribers. So if you are feeling generous and you'd like to support the show, how this is going to work is we're going to have an episode 1 week. The next week, there will be a newsletter. The next week, there's an episode, and so on and so forth. You can go to shtpost.substack.com to subscribe to that. All of that wrapped up. Let's go. Joining Shitpost now, we have a repeat guest, Emerson. You are actually one of the first guests on Shitpost in a, I will add, widely acclaimed interview I did about the book you co-authored, Like War. Old Shitpost heads, you know, the real heads of the show, will remember Emerson T. Brooking. He's a resident fellow at a place I work now, the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensic Research Lab. Emerson, welcome back to the show. It's been a while.
Thanks, Jared. It's awesome to be here.
Yeah, last time we recorded, we were in the cave. I think you'll remember my living situation at the time in a small windowless room saying, hello, sir. Thank you for coming on the show. Please follow me into this glorified closet that we're about to record in. The circumstances are a little different. I like to think we're both in better spots now.
That's right. Though I think all of us collectively are in small windowless rooms and have been for 9 months. So,
yeah, mentally at least, that's where I'm at. So, Emerson, you wrote a piece for DFR Lab that was really interesting that I really wanted to have you on to talk about. In the run-up to the 2020 election happening next week, by the time this episode comes out, it will be just a weekend away. October is always the month where campaigns, you know, give their final sales pitch to the American voters. And oftentimes that sales pitch comes with a scandal that is supposed to embroil the other campaign. There's a nickname for this in politics. It's called the October surprise. And the Trump campaign's October surprise in 2016 seemed to be WikiLeaks. It was a trove of Clinton aide emails that, you know, were spun and cherry-picked and, you know, purported to show all kinds of different things depending on the news source you consulted. And this year, it is Rudy Giuliani with what is supposedly, allegedly, I guess... will operate under the assumption that perhaps it is Hunter Biden's laptop, even though I have heard that he's not really giving it to anybody to independently verify. But it's not really hitting the same way that WikiLeaks hit. And you've got the numbers to prove it. But first, I want to zoom out just a little bit. Tell me about WikiLeaks in 2016 and how that played in the information space and what similarities that this New York Post reporting on Hunter Biden's supposed scandals compares to that.
Yeah, so my interest in this current moment is very much grounded in, I think, the kind of trauma that a lot of election watchers felt from the results of WikiLeaks in 2016. Because the best way to describe it, it was like an atomic bomb blast across the internet in how radically it changed the dynamics of the 2016 presidential race. And I will also always remember that date, October 7, when the tapes dropped, because it was a momentous day if you're talking about the history of presidential campaigns. First, that day was the only announcement by U.S. intelligence before the election that there seemed to be Russian interference in the campaign. And that came out of like U.S. intelligence channels, but that it took weeks for the Obama administration to basically agree on the wording, such that, you know, there wouldn't be the appearance of impropriety, like U.S. intelligence or other national security agencies were trying to swing the election one way or the other. So there's a very careful, calibrated statement that comes out on a Friday. And basically the whole Obama team's thinking, you know, whoa, we just set a historic precedent. We just made news. But something else broke 2 hours later, and that was the Access Hollywood tapes. And I think most folks listening are familiar with those. But they absolutely overwhelmed the Russian announcement such that no one knew about it. In the process of my digging, I went back and looked at the relative coverage of like Russian interference in 2016 versus Access Hollywood. If you combine the New York Times, Post, and Wall Street Journal coverage of this, you know, government announcement, it got about 40,000 shares on Facebook. The Access Hollywood exclusive from the Post alone got 400,000 shares.
Oh, so it's not even close.
No. So immediately this thing gets overwhelmed. And then I remember when the Access Hollywood tapes come out, and I'm you know, hanging out with some friends, and we say the race is over. You know, it's a morality crisis 3 weeks before the election. No candidates survived this, you know, whatever. This will be the defining narrative. But of course, a few hours after Access Hollywood, after kind of teasing and then failing to deliver earlier in the week, Julian Assange releases the first of the Podesta emails. That radically changes the composition of the race. The best way to describe that is Facebook used to put out a comprehensive report on the most popular topics that were being discussed on the platform each month. And then the month of October, that was like the most discussed thing was Halloween. Then it was the World Series because Chicago Cubs had won for the first time in over 100 years. And then it was WikiLeaks, really tied with the World Series in the frequency of discussion on the platform. It just spoke to the extraordinary impact that this event has. And because of the way Assange staggers the leaks from the Podesta emails, they continue to be news events throughout the entire election. They're obviously covered and heavily amplified in the far right and by pro-Trump proxies, but mainstream media and The Times, MSNBC, CNN, they also really got deep into covering the WikiLeaks emails. And there wasn't much, to be clear, there wasn't much evidence of impropriety in the emails, so long as you don't buy into like Pizzagate shit. But what mattered was that it became the emails, right? It kind of encapsulated. Hillary Clinton had never been a very trustworthy figure. Her trustworthiness was already low for a presidential candidate. The single word emails just became the expression for people who were uncomfortable with Clinton. There's been an argument put out by Kathleen Hall Jamieson at the University of Pennsylvania, who's been following presidential races for decades. She makes the case that it was the WikiLeaks releases specifically that doomed Clinton's campaign in 2016. The reason for that has to do with trustworthiness numbers, which are typically a very strong predictor for electoral performance. And Clinton's trustworthiness, again, never high, basically cannonballed in the final 3 weeks before the election. And she saw significantly diminished trustworthiness by the end of the third presidential debate, which came shortly after WikiLeaks, which was again something that had never happened. By the third presidential debate, voter opinions are generally formed. So WikiLeaks had quite a decisive impact on 2016. And that, of course, we've been waiting for a similar October surprise in 2020.
Right. And I want to go back to something that you cited just a minute ago. You mentioned that WikiLeaks and the World Series in October 2016, although the World Series was more discussed than WikiLeaks, that it was fairly close. And although the, you know, but her emails, whatever, you could say that's like a right-wing talking point, to be that discussed as much as a major sporting event or close to it, it you know, has to have broad appeal. And something that WikiLeaks had was even among maybe undecided voters or, you know, the more conservative breed of liberals that are out there. You know, there was great interest in these WikiLeaks emails. Like you said, it was, you know, Hillary Clinton, who has never been particularly trustworthy. You know, this, the feeling, the presentation of, you know, what she's really up to, and, you know, kind of all of the different spin-off stories that happened because of that. I mean, in the scope of the Hunter Biden story, stories that are coming now in the days since, is there that same sort of mass appeal? I feel like the only people that are touching the Hunter Biden stuff are hyperpartisan right-wing sites. Is that the case?
Yeah. Well, before we delve into the amplification and how it's different here, yeah, the appeal is fundamentally different. Because in 2016, people knew not to trust Hillary Clinton because of amplified scandals going back to the 90s. The Clintons were a well-established presence in national politics, and all the conspiracy theories were very old, which meant there were basically like layers of topsoil, and they would keep building and building and accumulating. So the WikiLeaks stuff just fit in quite well there. And WikiLeaks provided a foundation for all kinds of outlandish conspiracy theories, which you unfortunately have covered extensively over the last 4 years.
Unfortunately, yes. I like to remind people that the origin of QAnon was WikiLeaks emails. That was some of the original source material for those OG Q drops. You know, when people ask me if Pizzagate and QAnon are similar, I'm like, well, it's a lot of it is the same source material, at least the early days were. That WikiLeaks email drop is like almost single-handedly responsible for Pizzagate.
Yeah, it's the original sin of a lot of what we covered today. And that's because it offered, well, if you actually read the emails, it offered an unvarnished look into what high-level politics is like, which is like disgusting, you know, people trading on reputations all the time, people being curt or mean to each other or two-faced. That's nature of like politics. But what was more powerful about those emails was the fact that not that many people actually read them, but instead they could believe that anything was present. It was like a mystery box, and you could stick any narrative you wanted in that frame. And that's exactly what, again, our favorite conspiracy theorists did.
Emails about pizza became a sprawling conspiracy theory that now has implications at levels of politics that it frankly shouldn't.
The difference here is that the purported Hunter Biden emails, they show Hunter Biden trying to trade on the reputation of his father to make money. And they show images he took, many when he was in a period of distress. And a few things really blunt the impact there. First, I think after the Trump times, we are a little bit past being scandalized by presidential children, you know, making use of their parents' reputations. Is also the fact that none of this Hunter Biden stuff is particularly new. There was that huge expose last year, which went into great depth about Hunter Biden's struggles and the things that he'd done and his business dealings. So these emails provided a bit more color and substantiation to that, but not really more than that.
Additionally, there's also the element of the Hunter Biden scandal, and I guess this is maybe another similarity to WikiLeaks. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but the origins of the materials on this, you know, Hunter Biden laptop also come from, you know, a source with a history of, you know, at least cursory involvement or attempted targeting of foreign interference. Am I correct?
Oh, absolutely. God, this is really a rabbit hole. But in 2016, of course, both the DNC emails and then the Podesta emails were hacked by Russian military intelligence and then laundered through different sources. And the Russians, of course, tried to make their own WikiLeaks front before they settled on actually using WikiLeaks itself. So a lot of times when people say, you know, Julian Assange was a Russian agent, that calling someone an agent doesn't mean they were a totally knowledgeable and willing participant are working for the Russian state. It just means that they were used as a proxy. So that's what happened in 2016. So now the story in 2020 is that three laptops randomly show up in this Delaware computer repair guy's shop that have stickers on them from the Beau Biden Foundation. The owner of the laptops never returns, and they just happen to hold an immense amount of compromising information of Hunter Biden's personal texts and emails and images and videos.
Just regular stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And that this guy, you know, this repairman apparently follows all proper procedures by contacting the FBI and then immediately contacting the personal attorney of the President of the United States.
Right. We're still normal here.
I would just say it is possible that all of these events occurred. It is also possible on one of Rudy Giuliani's numerous trips to Ukraine, he got involved with folks who had probably already compromised Hunter Biden's emails and personal files. And then there was a way that might have been devised to similarly launder that information into the American media environment, same as 2016, when WikiLeaks was used for that purpose. That is the countervailing theory, and why it is not crazy to think about foreign involvement here. But the important thing to note, really, is that it's not the same seismic scandal, even if everything's on the level. Even if Hunter Biden really did fly back from LA to drop off three laptops with his brother's foundation sticker on them to a random repair guy.
Right, yeah. Even assuming that everything reported about these laptops is correct and factual, none of it is particularly, it's not a good look, I would say that, but it doesn't compromise Joe Biden in the same way that the WikiLeaks emails effectively compromised Hillary Clinton in the minds of so many voters.
There was a singular allegation that was actually directed at Joe Biden out of this initial email dump, and that was that according to emails from Ukrainian lobbyists, there was a suggested meeting between one of them and the vice president, which purportedly contradicted something that Joe Biden has said. But it wasn't really the case. The Biden campaign immediately opens up the official schedule of the vice president and shows that no, there never was any sort of meeting. So now, not only in order to keep following this thread, not only do you have to buy avidly into this corruption which extends to the vice president, but you have to believe that, like, you know, all official records are also a lie. So it's fundamentally different from WikiLeaks.
So we could probably spend hours on a WikiLeaks rabbit hole, just diving further and further into it until I can't see straight anymore and we both just pass out from going around in circles. But, you know, for all the comparisons to WikiLeaks, the Hunter Biden story, frankly, just doesn't hit like WikiLeaks did. And you did the research, you got the numbers. What did you find about the differences between how these two stories were covered?
So it hasn't hit the same as WikiLeaks in 2016, but it's not for lack of trying. And God bless them, especially Fox News. They are really trying. I used an awesome tool, which anyone can check out if they want. Just Google the Stanford Cable TV Analyzer, and you can search all the way back to 2010, anything that's mentioned on cable TV and with what frequency over any period of time between Fox, CNN, and MSNBC. And so that enabled me to just do some basic comparisons between WikiLeaks in 2016 and Hunter Biden in 2020. What I found was that MSNBC and CNN essentially did not cover the story in the first few days. The reason they didn't cover the story wasn't because they're in some great Democratic cabal. It's because there's no way to independently verify the veracity of the stuff on the hard drive. And the hard drive, unlike WikiLeaks, the metadata wasn't made publicly available to anyone except for a privileged Post reporter and Rudy Giuliani and Steve Bannon. So it's very difficult to objectively cover a story like that as you would as a journalist. But of course, if you're being used as a proxy for a political campaign, you care less about the sort of journalistic standards. Anyway, so CNN and MSNBC didn't cover it. Mainstream media outlets covered it very little. But on Fox News, it was a shotgun blast of coverage. By the second day, Fox was covering this story more than they had ever covered WikiLeaks in any one-day period. The most wild allegations.
Which that is truly remarkable, because anybody who was watching Fox at the time, I was at Media Matters, so that was like all I did was watch Fox News. They talked about WikiLeaks a lot. So you're telling me that just in the first like 24 hours, they blew that coverage out of the water?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm referring back to my chart now, and it is about 40% more coverage by in the first day than the peak of the WikiLeaks coverage. And something else is it actually took the WikiLeaks coverage a few days to heat up. Even Fox wasn't covering it that avidly initially, probably because of the Access Hollywood tape, which everyone did talk about to some extent. But here, with the Hunter Biden news cycle, that thing dropped on October 14, and it was immediately Fox's prime focus. And it has remained so. I actually ran updated numbers for this interview, and Fox is still covering it at a higher level than it ever covered WikiLeaks.
Wow.
And outside of a small blip during the last presidential debate where the president kind of tried and failed to bring up the tapes, and then CNN and MSNBC covered it, there has not been commensurate coverage from the other broadcasters. But then I wanted to contextualize this. So you can just run Google Trends search on WikiLeaks in 2016 versus Hunter Biden today. And that gives you a good idea of just the volume of search interest. And what blew me away is that Hunter Biden is now a significantly more popular search than WikiLeaks was at the height of the 2016 scandal. So you have a WikiLeaks-sized explosion that is contained entirely within one part of the media ecosystem. And it's the outlets that are promoting it most aggressively, like Fox News is the most sane among them. If you go on Facebook, I used just another media analysis tool to look at the articles that are being shared from websites about Hunter Biden. And there are about, I think, 31 million article shares related to this story in the first week.
Wow.
85% of those shares came from extremely far-right outlets. Like, yeah, even Ben Shapiro's in the middle of the pack there.
Wow. So it's not, I mean, you kind of joked it wasn't for a lack of trying, but you really weren't kidding. Yeah, I mean, that is humongous spread by, you know, the metric of nearly any political story.
As I think about it, for lower information Trump supporters who are in these Facebook ecosystems and who get their news from Fox, they have no reason not to believe this is the biggest scandal in history because it's being covered like it.
Right. And it certainly didn't help that, Twitter locked the New York Post's account, prevented it from sharing. It prevented, I think, any user from sharing a link to the New York Post story that's kicked off this whole thing. It is the cover-up. It is the story the mainstream media doesn't want you to see. Among these hyper-partisan audiences, this is the hot shit right now.
Yeah. It was pretty ironic because if you talk to people at these platforms, their number one concern is, you know, we failed on WikiLeaks. We allowed a foreign hack and leak operation to spread all over our platforms and kind of fundamentally change a presidential race. We don't want that to happen again. So Facebook, Twitter, and all these folks, like, WikiLeaks is their reference point. They've been endlessly, like, kind of gaming out how they would deal with this kind of scandal. So then when a scandal like this actually broke on the 14th, they definitely overreacted a little bit. Twitter especially, the way I think about it, they probably had all of these approvals and decisions made in advance. But what had not been considered enough was the logical fallout from these initial decisions. You know, if you're a Trump supporter and there's like the biggest story of the election and then Twitter literally keeps you from sharing the link to it, are you going to be deterred or think that it's less of a big deal? I don't think there was sufficient consideration.
Right, especially when a mainstream conservative talking point among media and even prominent politicians, as we saw in a recent Section 230 meeting in up on Capitol Hill, is this repeated claim that big tech is some sort of far-left conspiracy working against conservatives. This has been in the zeitgeist for a long time, and now suddenly, you know, if you are a Trump supporter or, you know, run-of-the-mill conservative who buys into that, boom, here's your proof, and they're doing it to protect Joe Biden. That's what I keep seeing claimed all over, that, you know, these tech companies want to protect Joe Biden for some reason.
It had already been insane that the Congress had scheduled, and Democrats had got along with, a social media hearing less than a week before the election. Because what are the chances that was going to be anything but like a conservative grievance fest over, you know, purported bias in these policies?
Right.
But that thing was scheduled before Hunter Biden. So obviously after that, that was all the hearing was going to be about. And we saw that. We saw how, you know, Ted Cruz teased the hearing by tweeting out an image of him looking like a boxer, like ready to beat up Jack Dorsey.
I'm going to have to dissent from the pack and say that that was awesome. That was maybe top, maybe like top, I wouldn't say top five. I'd give it a generous top 10 ranking of like just absurd, dumb shit that happened this year.
Well, all right. Sometimes they do hit homers. That and Cocaine Mitch is still pretty good. But what's also remarkable is, like, they're, you know, the owns that they got in on Dorsey and Zuckerberg didn't exactly, like, carry the news cycle either. It really feels like they're floundering.
Right, because there's not a whole lot of, like, factual information to back them up. So routinely we see at these hearings, they just wheel out these anecdotes.
I'm going to make a labored analogy, but I just got Microsoft Flight Simulator. And so I've been thinking about airplanes. And this scandal is like, is basically like going into a stall, right? Where you, you keep increasing rotation and the plane's going at a sharper and sharper angle of attack such that like the thrust can't keep up, but you just keep trying until you eventually like plummet to the ground because there wasn't enough to keep you sustained. They're trying everything they can do right now. You know, they're flapping their wings. They're doing anything they can to continue to generate lift out of something that fundamentally is not the kind of scandal potential that WikiLeaks was in 2016. And, you know, you hate to see it.
Yeah, one of the sites that I've observed really, really trying to go for it is Gateway Pundit. You know, the product of Jim Hoft, smartest guy on the internet for sure. You know, they have been publishing these stories that are just increasingly suggestive that Hunter Biden's laptop actually contains pornography of him with, I think it's his niece or something. You know, really just going full gun Pizzagate on this. And I guess we might see more of that. That might just be the direction this goes if they can't get traction among, you know, the legitimate political, call it, the serious people in the room.
Well, they actually already tried it. I was amazed because I'm so happy it didn't land. It didn't make a story. But last weekend, they released these explicit videos from Hunter Biden's laptop. They weren't covered by the Post. They weren't covered by most even far-right media. These videos actually appeared on something associated with it's called the New Federal State of China, which is a nonsense front organization that was launched by Steve Bannon in June of this year, I think after the laptops were in their possession. So it's purportedly run by Chinese dissidents, but it's really run by Steve Bannon. And then it shared these explicit images and videos of Hunter Biden. I did some research on like the spread of this over the weekend. And insofar as I can tell, the social media companies immediately kept this from being shared because this is an obvious violation of terms of service stuff. It's like, you know, it's revenge porn, basically. Right. And the only even far-right outlet that I saw pick it up was the Gateway Pundit, which was just pure demonstration of just how vile Houghton Company had gotten, that they're reaching like that low to try to generate lift off it. And it looked like it got maybe 1,000 Facebook shares before Facebook tamped down on it.
Zooming out, I guess all of this begs the question, what's different this time? We've already talked about how, you know, the there for the Hunter Biden scandal just simply isn't. And also some different, you know, tech moderation, the isolated chambers. You know, zooming out a bit, what makes this time so much different than WikiLeaks in 2016? This was the Trump campaign's, you know, October surprise. But now it's become so convoluted and messy that, you know, even I, as somebody who tries to keep up with this stuff on a regular basis, like, have trouble following parts of it. What is different this time?
The first thing is that the Trump team came out of 2016 thinking they were way smarter than they actually were. They think that they, you know, engineered a brilliant reversal right when Trump was about to get counted out, and that he came back from the dead, he rallied the base. You know, it's a fantastic sort of redemption arc if you're looking at it from a Trump supporter's point of view. That's also how Trump sees it. He sees it as through like sheer God Emperor force of will. He worked his way past a scandal and expertly capitalized on an opponent's scandal. What happened in reality is that the Trump team kind of tripped over their own dicks into a foreign intelligence operation, which helped lift President Trump to victory. That stuff just doesn't happen whenever you want. You can't make that happen. But the lesson they took from 2016 was that it was their own brilliance, and they could use this, you know, these dark arts media manipulation to do it again. And you know, people like Steve Bannon in particular think they're like these dark brooding geniuses. When you're not busy trying to train fascists in an Italian monastery, you're expertly
or pretending that you like the pop music from your billionaire beneficiary. Who's keeping you afloat? Yeah, it's oh man, remember when Steve Bannon was supposed to be like the serious guy that everyone had to try to understand?
That is something where the media has failed abjectly, because he always makes himself available for comment, and people just like they can't help themselves. You know, it's like an addiction. When my co-author and I were wrapping up Like War, you know, part of the book writing process is to figure out, you know, who's going to endorse it. And it was just floated to us that, like, Steve Bannon was happy to endorse books. Like, our book was extremely critical of Trump. He was just available. He's very good at playing the media that way.
Right.
We obviously didn't go for that, but it was shocking, like, what an operator he was and how many people you've used him for anonymous comments over the years.
Right. I've always told people perhaps the best skill that Steve Bannon has is convincing people who write for prestige publications that he is more influential than he is or more powerful than he is. But eventually it becomes a self-feeding cycle. But yeah, back on track a little bit. You know, all of this was a perfect storm in 2016. And, you know, like you said, the Trump campaign kind of tripped over their dicks and fell into a foreign influence operation. And it seemed like this time, like, they were really desperate to try to, like, figure out where their dicks were so they could trip over them again. Is that fair to say?
We might be getting a little bit lost in this one, but I'd about call it like that. What I'd say is, so for a lot of folks on the left, they lost the Russia thread and the Russiagate stuff. Because there was a foreign intelligence operation, but then, you know, I think for a lot of your listeners, there was a general feeling that the Democratic Party began to use the existence of a Russian operation to cover up for its own failings in policy and campaigning, which also accounted for the 2016 loss. And then, in general, allegations of foreign interference are used to marginalize far-left candidates. they've been repeatedly used to marginalize Bernie Sanders. People would say, oh, you know, the Russians supported you. You were part of Russian kompromat or some shit like that. The reason I'm talking about this is think about when the Russia story got really complicated. Like by mid-2018, when there were like 40 different characters you had to keep track of, people had pinned all of their hopes and dreams on the outcome of the Mueller report. But you had to have like a PhD in this stuff to keep the storyline straight and all the allegations of corruption and influence and the difference between Russian advertising, Russian sock puppets, and Russian hacking. It wasn't an easy storyline anymore. You had to be really invested in it. And that's kind of what it is with this Hunter Biden stuff now. It's not mysterious emails which could expose the existence of a giant child-eating cabal under Comet Pizza. Instead, it's like it's a whole cast of characters that eventually veer into corruption, but not really lawbreaking, which could eventually, in theory, work their way back to Biden the candidate. It's just fundamentally different. You have to be so much more engaged in this stuff to even follow the storyline. So I think that's a big reason it's just not catching on.
So we're on the descent here. So I want to also make sure that I talk to you about an op-ed that you wrote with Graham Brookie, who is the director, managing editor for DFR Lab, that focused on threats of this disinformation. As far as I know, whether or not the Hunter Biden scandal is in fact a foreign interference, a foreign op, is unconfirmed. Is that right?
Right.
It's sort of, one of those things where it's like, it smells fishy and a lot of intelligence officials have raised concerns about it, but there's not exactly hard proof at this date. These disinformation campaigns or, the threat of disinformation, while it certainly does come from foreign adversaries, recently we saw campaigns coming out of Iran, China to some extent. Ultimately, the disinformation threat is much more potent as a domestic one. Can you explain what you mean by that? Because when you hear disinformation influence campaigns, a lot of this through the Mueller campaign, through WikiLeaks, and all that coverage, we tend to think of it as something kind of foreign to us, something that infiltrates, rather than something that's sort of breeding inside our own country.
Yeah. Oh, great question. And okay, so assume that this Hunter Biden stuff is entirely domestic. What's the next biggest foreign interference campaign that's affected the 2020 election? It's probably last week when folks affiliated with the Iranian government sent about 150 emails to Democrats in Florida saying that the Proud Boys were going to come and hurt them if they voted in the election. That did get a lot of immediate press coverage and then a swift attribution from the U.S. government. But I promise you, in the day-to-day coverage of the president's misleading statements or outright falsehoods, it barely registers. It's a blip. And then if we go to the next biggest thing, it's probably when Russia was running both a far left and a far right website trying to pay American freelancers to write for them. And the Russians, this was the Internet Research Agency, and the Russians, from what I understand, were actually pretty good editors. They gave fair compensation. They gave constructive editing feedback. But of course, they used AI-generated faces instead of their real identities. But their intention, I guess, was to polarize U.S. domestic conversation. But the sites that they ran had absolutely trivial engagement. Sometimes they publish stories that would get fewer than 50 hits.
Wow.
So again, it just the effect of these campaigns is trivial when you compare it to any disinformation actor in the U.S. domestic space. Think about the stuff that Dan Bongino, I can't
Bongino.
Say his name,
but
Bongino, the stuff that he's Facebook king. You know, he's commanding millions of shares a week of, like, outright fabrications and nonsense.
Right. I mean, like, there's Hyperpartisan and there's Dan Bongino literally sweating, screaming into the camera at you. And then, you know, I guess people on Facebook are looking at that and they're like, yes, that this is what I like.
Yeah, I did. You love to see that, right?
That's... We quite truly love to see it, Dan. Keep it up.
Yeah, it escapes me why you'd want to, like, calm down each night with Dan Bongino. But, you know, hundreds of thousands of Americans do that. Okay, but even if you look beyond those sorts of actors in the space, we recently saw an attributed troll farm in the United States, a troll farm that looked a lot like the Russian troll farm. It was this place out of Arizona called Rally Forge. They were working for Turning Points USA, and they were hiring teenagers to create fake Instagram and Facebook accounts to mostly, like, either share news or go kind of astroturf on different news articles in support of the president or pro Talking Points, Turning Points USA causes. And they commanded so much more engagement than any foreign effort. This network that Facebook took down, which this Rally Forge troll farm was running, had something like 400,000 followers, almost all of them in the United States. We have not seen any comparable effort in 2020 from a foreign actor.
In my mind, I imagine that the troll farm is like 500 teenagers working minimum wage in a factory floor that is way too hot for some reason. All, you know, it's like the scene from that iconic Apple commercial where there's the big screen and they're all sitting there with their phones and Benny Johnson is just projecting one meme at a time and they have to go like and hit the share button. Otherwise, Benny gets really upset. But unfortunately, it was a bit more sinister than that. And it's kind of amazing that Facebook took this network down, but there hasn't seemed to be a whole lot of additional fallout for Turning Point USA. If this happens from a adversarial, you know, foreign enemy trying to influence us in this way, I remember in the Mueller investigation, several people were charged for that. But is any framework to do something similar? I guess ultimately my question is there any sort of structure of accountability present for domestic forces that seek to do the same thing?
First off, we're running up against the limits of content moderation. So, and this is something, like, I've been doing a lot of work related to election security and election-related disinformation. And a big tension is that when one side of the presidential contest is perpetually misleading voters and delegitimizing electoral processes, how do you protect the election without simply removing one of the two candidates running? And that is the fundamental problem that these companies are encountering, is they try to create these policies and try to equally enforce them without taking action that would get them severely punished, but which would also more broadly not be very good for the democratic fabric in the United States. So that's the, in general, the challenge they encounter. And they encounter that same sort of challenge when a huge pro-Trump advocacy group is flouting their own rules. They basically, if it's an American entity that's doing this stuff, these companies basically have a much higher threshold before they'll take action against them. Frankly, I think action should have been taken against Turning Point USA. It's clear that they were contracting with this group, and one has to assume that they understood the tools and tactics that this group was using.
Right. I can't imagine that a service like this would be inexpensive either.
It doesn't happen. And there have been so many instances of this where it's, you know, we recently saw the story about Facebook responding to allegations of anti-conservative bias, like suppressed Mother Jones on Facebook. There's always been this overreaction, which almost always serves to boost or benefit far-right entities on Facebook. In part because we we now have better understandings of Facebook traffic patterns because far-right entities are the ones that use Facebook the most. Like, if you look at the top 10 on Facebook, it's Mr. Bogino and company who are always the ones.
It's Mr. Bogino and Bean Shapino.
yeah, exactly. But I do also want to say, I think there's a broader political, there's a broader revolution in political communications that we're also dealing with. Because it's not appropriate for people to create fake accounts and to astroturf, right? But what if these teens had just been like coordinating on Discord and then using their real identities and just like brigading pages? Some people would call that coordinated inauthentic behavior, but a lot of other people would argue, I think rightly, that it's also a form of political expression. That there are broader changes going on in how society, especially how Gen Z, like, engage politically. And so some of our definitions of what we consider, you know, like shadowy disinformation will eventually have to shift to accommodate this new reality.
Broadly speaking, as we are running up on time here, you know, the information landscape is always changing at a blistering pace. But in terms of the future dealing with disinformation, misinformation, whether domestic or foreign, are you hopeful for the future? And, you know, can we end this on a positive note? Should we be optimistic about the potential to, you know, actually figure this out and get this right?
One thing that should give us some hope is that once these companies are, once events compel these companies to take actions, they very rarely reverse these decisions or actions. So it has taken the election and quite a lot of public pressure for like Facebook to move decisively against QAnon, to actually ban Holocaust denialism on their platform, even to be better at cracking down on white identitarianism. But now that they've taken these steps and begun to push these extreme movements off the platform, it is extremely unlikely that they'll reverse, regardless of who wins the presidential election. So we have begun to move in the right direction, where these spaces are safer for more people, and where the most vile, toxic content doesn't necessarily have the same place in the public sphere. So that, I would say, is a positive step, and that's going to stay with us.
So we've been talking to Emerson T. Brooking, resident fellow at the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensic Research Lab, all about, you know, the Hunter Biden mishap and WikiLeaks and whatever other rabbit holes we found ourselves going down. But Emerson, I've got one more question for you, and you've been on the show, it's been a while, but what's your favorite thing on the internet right now?
Jared, I am prepared this time, and I'm very happy you asked that question. My absolute favorite thing on the internet last few days has been brunch discourse.
Go on.
Absolutely. So I still don't know how it started. It doesn't matter. But the left has been consumed in a conversation about brunch. Is it anti-LGBT to not like brunch? Is it anti-woman to not like brunch? Is it somehow anti-exclusive to not like brunch? Or is it classist to like brunch? Many different voices have fallen down on different sides of this issue. There have been, you know, layers within layers of this debate. Some people have been brunch-pilled. Some people haven't. But what I absolutely love about it is, first off, it's a testament to how the left can argue endlessly about anything. And second, it is such a passionate debate that is ultimately so trivial that it helps lift the spirits when you're engaging all day with the election and with the future of American democracy.
So, you know what I have to ask. What's your take on brunch?
I hate it, but I miss it. Because I miss being at a table with friends and having the cheapest mimosas we can get.
Oh, I hear you there. Emerson T. Brooking, thanks for joining.
Thank you.